Chapter 95. Esther's narrative. I lay ill through several weeks, and the usual tenor of my life became like an old remembrance. But this was not the effect of time, so much as of the change in all my habits made by the helplessness and inaction of a sick room. Before I had been confined to it many days, everything else seemed to have retired into a remote distance where there was little or no separation between the various stages of my life which had been really divided by years. In falling ill, I seemed to have crossed a dark lake, and to have left all my experiences, mingled together by the great distance, on the healthy shore. My housekeeping duties, though at first it caused me great anxiety to think that they were unperformed, were soon as far off as the oldest of the old duties at Greenleaf for the summer afternoons, when I went home from school with my portfolio under my arm, and my childish shadow at my side, to my godmother's house. I had never known before how short life really was, and into how small a space the mind could put it. While I was very ill, the way in which these divisions of time became confused with one another distressed my mind exceedingly. At once a child, an elder girl, and the little woman I had been so happy as, I was not only oppressed by cares and difficulties adapted to each station, but by the great perplexity of endlessly trying to reconcile them. I suppose that few who have not been in such a condition can quite understand what I mean, or what painful unrest arose from this source. For the same reason I am almost afraid to hint at that time in my disorder it seemed one long night, but I believe there were both nights and days in it, when I labored up colossal staircases, ever striving to reach the top, and ever turned, as I have seen a worm in a garden path, by some obstruction, and laboring again. I knew perfectly at intervals, and I think vaguely at most times, that I was in my bed, and I talked with Charlie, and felt her touch, and knew her very well, yet I would find myself complaining, oh, more of these never-ending stairs, Charlie more and more piled up to the sky, I think, and laboring on again. Dare I hint at that worst time when, strung together somewhere in great black space, there was a flaming necklace, a ring, or starry circle of some kind, of which I was one of the beads. And when my only prayer was to be taken off from the rest, and when it was such inexplicable agony and misery to be a part of the dreadful thing. Perhaps the less I say of these sick experiences, the less tedious and the more intelligible I shall be. I do not recall them to make others unhappy, or because I am now the least unhappy in remembering them. It may be that, if we knew more of such strange afflictions, we might be the better able to alleviate their intensity. The repose that succeeded, the long delicious sleep, the blissful rest, when in my weakness I was too calm to have any care for myself, and could have heard her so I think now, that I was dying, with no other emotion than with a pitying love for those I left behind, this state can be perhaps more widely understood. I was in this state, when I first shrunk from the light as it twinkled on me once more, and knew with a boundless joy for which no words are rapturous enough, that I should see again. I had heard my Ada crying at the door, day and night. I had heard her calling to me, that I was cruel, and did not love her. I had heard her praying and imploring, to be let in, to nurse and comfort me, and to leave my bedside no more. But I had only said, when I could speak, never, my sweet girl, never. And I had over and over again reminded Charlie, that she was to keep my darling from the room, whether I lived or died. Charlie had been true to me in that time of need, and with her little hand and her great heart had kept the door fast. But now, my sight strengthening, and the glorious light coming every day more fully and brightly on me, I could read the letters that my dear wrote to me every morning and evening, and could put them to my lips, and lay my cheek upon them with no fear of hurting her. I could see my little maid, so tender and so careful, going about the two rooms setting everything in order and speaking cheerfully to Ada from the open window again. I could understand the stillness in the house, and the thoughtfulness it expressed on the part of all those who had always been so good to me. I could weep in the exquisite felicity of my heart, and be as happy in my weakness as ever I had been in my strength. By and by my strength began to be restored. Instead of lying, with so strange a calmness, watching what was done for me, as if it were done for someone else whom I was quietly sorry for, I helped it a little, and so on to a little more and much more, until I became useful to myself, and interested, and attached to life again. How well I remember the pleasant afternoon, when I was raised in bed with pillows for the first time to enjoy a great tea drinking with Charlie. The little creature sent into the world, surely, to minister to the weak and sick was so happy, and so busy, and stopped so often in her preparations, to lay her head upon my bosom, and fondle me, and cry with joyful tears she was so glad, that I was obliged to say, Charlie, if you go on in this way, I must lie down again, my darling, for I am weaker than I thought I was. So Charlie became as quiet as a mouse, and took her bright face here and there across and across the two rooms, out of the shade into the divine sunshine, and out of the sunshine into the shade, while I watched her peacefully. When all her preparations were concluded, and the pretty tea table with its little delicacies to tempt me, and its white cloth, and its flowers, and everything so lovingly and beautifully arranged for me by Ada downstairs, was ready at the bedside, I felt sure I was steady enough to say something to Charlie that was not new to my thoughts. First I complimented Charlie on the room, and indeed it was so fresh and airy, so spotless and neat, that I could scarce believe I had been lying there so long. This delighted Charlie, and her face was brighter than before. Yet, Charlie, said I, looking round, I miss something, surely, that I am accustomed to? Poor little Charlie looked round too, and pretended to shake her head, as if there were nothing absent. Are the pictures all as they used to be? I asked her. Every one of them, miss, said Charlie. And the furniture, Charlie? Except where I have moved it about to make more room, miss. And yet, said I miss some familiar object. Ah, I know what it is, Charlie. It's the looking glass. Charlie got up from the table, making as if she had forgotten something, and went into the next room, and I heard her sob there. I had thought of this very often. I was now certain of it. I could thank God that it was not a shock to me now. I called Charlie back, and when she came at first pretending to smile, but as she drew nearer to me, looking grieved, I took her in my arms and said, It matters very little, Charlie. I hope I can do without my old face very well. I was presently so far advanced as to be able to sit up in a great chair, and even giddily to walk into the adjoining room, leaning on Charlie. The mirror was gone from its usual place in that room too, but what I had to bear was none the harder to bear for that. My guardian had throughout been earnest to visit me, and there was now no good reason why I should deny myself that happiness. He came one morning, and when he first came in, could only hold me in his embrace and say, My dear, dear girl. I had long known who could know better? What a deep fountain of affection and generosity his heart was, and was it not worth my trivial suffering and change to fill such a place in it? Oh, yes, I thought. He has seen me, and he loves me better than he did. He has seen me, and is even fonder of me than he was before, and what have I to mourn for? He sat down by me on the sofa, supporting me with his arm. For a little while he sat with his hand over his face, but when he removed it, fell into his usual manner. There never can have been, there never can be, a pleasanter manner. My little woman, said he, what a sad time this has been. Such an inflexible little woman too, through all. Only for the best, guardian, said one. For the best, he repeated tenderly. Of course, for the best. But here have Ada and I been perfectly forlorn and miserable. Here has your friend Caddy been coming and going late and early. Here has everyone about the house been utterly lost and dejected. Here has even poor Rick been writing to me too in his anxiety for you. I had read of Caddy in Ada's letters, but not of Richard. I told him so. Why, no, my dear, he replied. I have thought it better not to mention it to her. And you speak of his writing to you, said I, repeating his emphasis. As if it were not natural for him to do so, guardian. As if he could write to a better friend. He thinks he could, my love, returned my guardian, and to many a better. The truth is, he wrote to me under a sort of protest, while unable to write to you with any hope of an answer, wrote coldly, haughtily, distantly, resentfully. Well, dearest little woman, we must look forbearingly on it. He is not to blame. Jarndyce and Jarndyce has warped him out of himself, and perverted me in his eyes. I have known it do as bad deeds, and worse, many a time. If two angels could be concerned in it, I believe it would change their nature. It has not changed yours, guardian. Oh, yes, it has, my dear, he said laughingly. It has made the south wind easterly, I don't know how often. Rick mistrusts and suspects me, goes to lawyers, and is taught to mistrust and suspect me. Here's I have conflicting interests, claims clashing against his and what not. Whereas, heaven knows that, if I could get out of the mountains of agglomeration on which my unfortunate name has been so long bestowed, which I can't, or could level them by the extinction of my own original right, which I can't either, and no human power ever can, anyhow, I believe, to such a pass have we got, I would do it this hour. I would rather restore to poor Rick his proper nature than be endowed with all the money that dead suitors, broken, heart and soul, upon the wheel of chancery, have left unclaimed with the accountant general, and that's money enough, my dear, to be cast into a pyramid, in memory of chancery's transcendent wickedness. Is it possible, guardian, I asked, amazed, that Richard can be suspicious of you? Ah, my love, he said, it is in the subtle poison of such abuses to breed such diseases. His blood is infected, and objects lose their natural aspects in his sight. It is not his fault. But it is a terrible misfortune, guardian. It is a terrible misfortune, little woman, to be ever drawn within the influences of Jarndyce and Jarndyce. I know none greater. By little and little he has been induced to trust in that rotten reed, and it communicates some portion of its rottenness to everything around him. But again I say with all my soul, we must be patient with poor Rick, and not blame him. What a troop of fine fresh hearts like his have I seen in my time turned by the same means. I could not help expressing something of my wonder and regret that his benevolent, disinterested intentions had prospered so little. We must not say so, Dom Durden, he cheerfully refed. Odd is the happier, I hope, and that is much. I did think that I and both these young creatures might be friends instead of distrustful foes, and that we might, so far, counteract the suit, and prove too strong for it. But it was too much to expect. Jarndyce and Jarndyce was the curtain of Rick's cradle. But, guardian, may we not hope that a little experience will teach him what a false and wretched thing it is? We will hope so, my Esther, said Mr. Jarndyce, and that it may not teach him so too late. In any case, we must not be hard on him. There are not many grown and matured men living while we speak, good men too, who if they were thrown into the same court as suitors would not be vitally changed, and depreciated within 3 years, within two, within one. How can we stand amazed at poor Rick? A young man so unfortunate, here he fell into a lower tone, as if he were thinking aloud, cannot at first believe, who could? That chancery is what it is. He looks to it, flushed and fitfully, to do something with his interests, and bring them to some settlement. It procrastinates, disappoints, tries, tortures him, wears out his sanguine hopes and patience, thread by thread. But he still looks to it, and hankers after it, and finds his whole world treacherous and hollow. Well, well, well. Enough of this, my dear. He had supported me, as at first, all this time, and his tenderness was so precious to me, that I leaned my head upon his shoulder, and loved him, as if he had been my father. I resolved in my own mind in this little pause, by some means, to see Richard when I grew strong, and try to set him right. There are better subjects than these, said my guardian, for such a joyful time as the time of our dear girl's recovery. And I had a commission to broach one of them as soon as I should begin to talk. When shall Ada come to see you, my love? I had been thinking of that too. A little in connection with the absent mirrors, but not much, for I knew my loving girl would be changed by no change in my looks. Dear guardian, said I, as I have shut her out so long though indeed, she is like a light to me, I know it well, Dom Durden, well. He was so good, his touch expressed such endearing compassion and affection, and the tone of his voice carried such comfort into my heart, that I stopped for a little while, quite unable to go on. Yes, yes, you are tired, said he, rest a little. As I have kept Ada out so long, I began afresh after a short while, I think I should like to have my own way a little longer, guardian. It would be best to be away from here, before I see her. If Charlie and I were to go to some country lodging, as soon as I can move, and if I had a week there in which to grow stronger, and to be revived by the sweet air, and to look forward to the happiness of having Ada with me again, I think it would be better for us. I hope it was not a poor thing in me to wish to be a little more used to my altered self, before I met the eyes of the dear girl I longed so ardently to see, but it is the truth. I did. He understood me, I was sure, but I was not afraid of that. If it were a poor thing, I knew he would pass it over. Our spoiled little woman, said my guardian, shall have her own. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.